Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Professor Erin Busby. She is the co-director of the Supreme Court Clinic at the University of Texas School of Law. Welcome to our podcast, Professor Busby.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
If you recognize Professor Busby's name, we'll just put it on out there right now. Yes, she is related to a previous guest of our podcast. And I bring this up now because probably more than once during this episode, I will slip and say Justice Busby instead of Professor Busby. But I'm sure she'll own up to being married to Justice Brett Busby from the Supreme Court of Texas.
Yes, yes, for almost 20 years now.
You claim him? Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us today. We won't linger on that relationship too long, but it's good to get it out there. And maybe toward the end of the show, we'll get to where we're telling some stories on your husband. But for now, we really want to focus on you.
And that's right.
We wanted to have you on the podcast for a number of reasons. But one is to talk about the Supreme Court Clinic at UT. But before we get to that, will you tell us a little about your background and how you came to be a lawyer?
Sure. I grew up mostly on the East Coast, near Boston, some near Philadelphia. And my father was a lawyer, although he did not practice for most of the time I was a child. He went into being an executive. So I went to college at William & Mary in Virginia and decided I wanted to go to law school. So I headed up to go to Harvard for law school. I spent another year in Boston after that, clerking for Michael Boudin on the First Circuit. From there, I went to clerk for Justice Stephen Breyer in Washington. After clerking, I went to New York for a couple of years. I was actually a tax lawyer, which is not something everyone knows about me. Eventually decided two important things. One, I would rather be an appellate lawyer. And two, I wanted to marry this guy who I'd started dating in Washington who had moved to Houston. So two birds with one stone, moved to Houston, became an appellate lawyer. I practiced with Bracewell. It was then Bracewell and Patterson and then Bracewell and Giuliani for a few years. Once I had kids, I decided the law firm thing was not necessarily what I wanted to do and started working part-time with the UT Supreme Court Clinic. And as the years have gone on, I've picked up more and more of that to the point that I'm now the co-director of the clinic and have been for a few years now.
Well, Bracewell was the firm where I know your husband, I don't want to keep calling your husband. We'll just say Justice.
You can call him Brett.
Hey, we're all friends here. We'll just call him. We'll call him Brett. Bracewell was a firm where Brett had spent some time too, as I recall. Did you all overlap
at that time? No. I had left already and was doing independent work and, you know, raising kids when Brett interviewed. And he relayed that one of the interviewers said, "This mean Erin's really not coming back?" And he said, "Yeah, she's not."
I just have to back up a minute because I'm curious. When you were on the First Circuit, did you get a chance to go to Puerto Rico to sit with them? Because I think that's such an interesting little jurisdictional nugget.
It is, and I did not get to go. My judge was not a fan of the trip to Puerto Rico.
I don't understand why. It's a beautiful place. But no, that's quite a history, you know, going. It is useful to us to hear your story about how you wound up in Texas, marrying a Texas bred and born and bred.
Yes.
Brett Busby, who, you know, again, we won't linger on him too long, but this is going beyond our usual name drop in our podcast a little bit. But So, well, the first circuit, and of course, I think we, most of us know, you know, a circuit clerkship is generally a prerequisite to spending time at the Supreme Court of the United States. Tell us about your experience clerking for Justice Breyer.
Well, it was a great experience. Justice Breyer is, to start with, and it's not unimportant, he's a really nice guy. Mm-hmm. And he is, I joke that I clerked for two judges who were very secure in how smart they were, which meant that they wanted you to bring your best arguments, all of your thoughts about cases, whether or not they aligned with what the judge or justice was thinking about the case to begin with. They wanted to hear everything and incorporate everything into opinions that they would write. So a Supreme Court clerk helps go through cert petitions. Justice Breyer was in the cert pool, which means his clerks get, at that point, it was 1/8 of all the petitions to divide amongst the four of us. And you basically write memos doing a bit of a summary of the case so the justices can go through those faster. And then you work to prepare for argument and you work on opinions with the justice. Some justices have you write big, long memos about every case that's going to argument. Justice Breyer would just ask for what he thought he needed in a case, which might be a full workup. It might be just one aspect of the case. I can think of one case where he came out and he said, "Can you just write every good argument you could find for affirming the decision below?" He's like, I've got the other side covered. So in that way, and it's funny because Justice Breyer comes off very much like the absent-minded professor, I think. And in some ways he is. You know, he has a tendency to walk into your office asking you a question about a case that he has started 4 feet before he actually entered your office. And you have to like quick catch up and figure out what case he's talking about. But in other ways, he's like an intensely practical person. So he's not going to have somebody do a bunch of work that he doesn't need them to do. So that's that was, you know, working with the justice. I had three great co-clerks who we shared offices with and worked together with. And then you also spend a lot of time with, at least the year I was there, with the clerks for the other justices. So there's about 36 of you there. You're there a lot. You know, a vast majority of your time is spent in that building. And it varies from year to year. Some years I have heard it's not a great atmosphere. I got lucky. The year I was there, it was. People got along over, you know, what would be considered ideological lines or partisan lines. And it was just a lot of sort of smart people trying to do good work, trying to have a little fun since we were all there.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Which term did you clerk?
I clerked in the 99 term. So right before Bush versus Gore.
I was going to ask, were there any particularly notable opinions from your term that stuck with you?
Oh, goodness. And I am not going to remember names. We had a partial birth abortion case. We had a First Amendment abortion protest bubble case. Mm-hmm. We had the Miranda redo, whether Congress could pass a law, basically erasing Miranda. Yeah, it was funny. We had so many sort of hot button issues that when we came to the end of our term, we said, oh, next year is going to be so boring compared to our year.
Little did they know.
Yeah. So
of course, you know, every term there's hot button cases, but mm-hmm. but no, I'm sure during the time you're there, it sure seems that way, that yours is the toughest term in terms of, you know, controversial issues.
I'm sure. And the truth is, I think that pretty much every case that ends up at the Supreme Court is interesting because mm-hmm. it's difficult enough generally that courts of appeals have come out different ways on it. So there's got to be something going on there that's interesting if you dig in enough. Mm-hmm. So it's not, the hot button issues make all the press about cases, but it's all interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, Justice Breyer has obviously been in the news a lot with his retirement coming up. I'm just curious, whatever insights, whether, you know, personal or legal, you can share about his kind of impact on the Supreme Court or the law or anything like that, his legacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you know, I mentioned before him being a very practical person. I think that really was his approach to the law as well, which in some ways may, it leaves less of sort of a sweeping legacy than someone who was very much more theory driven. Mm-hmm. Whereas Justice Breyer really wanted to apply things to the facts of that case. One example that probably most people have heard of are the Ten Commandments cases, whereas one was about the Ten Commandments monument on the Texas Capitol grounds, and one was about a courthouse in Alabama, I believe. And those two related cases both came out 5-4, but the one in the courthouse was ruled unconstitutional. And as visitors to the Texas Capitol will have noticed, the Texas one's still there. And the only difference in the voting lineup between those two cases was Justice Breyer, who looked at the history of when the things were put up, the context they were in, and said, you know, there is a lot of history of the one in Texas. It's in this sort of park-like setting with lots of different monuments by lots of different groups, and that wouldn't express that the state was establishing this religion, while the context, the history, swung the other way for the Alabama case. And that's a very Justice Breyer thing. You know, people joke he never met a 7-factor balancing test he didn't like. Which is, you know, there's a certain aspect of truth to that. And, you know, and he would apply balancing tests to areas where certainly a lot of people would not, such as the First Amendment. So I think that there will be a legacy of that approach somewhat, but it will be more muted, I think, than some other legacies that there may be.
You had some relatively, now I would say, famous co-clerks besides Brett, which if we didn't make that connection before, we should make sure and clarify.
Yes, that is how we met.
Right. And so, I mean, you very sort of subtly said you met him when you were in Washington, but you certainly had a unique opportunity to, in addition to clerking for Justice Breyer, to meet your future spouse while clerking. Yes. You know, there are some of those stories like that in Texas, you know, through the Texas Supreme Court and I think Fifth Circuit clerkships, but y'all's is a really great story. I mean, this relationship blossoms and next thing you know, you're married with kids and Brett's a justice on the Texas Supreme Court and you're teaching at UT. It's sort of, yeah. You know, sounds a little idyllic, but I know that as with everything, there's, you know, way more to the story than just where you are now. It's interesting that it also, you know, relates to Justice Breyer in a way. So should we keep our audience waiting any longer before we reveal the connection that I'm getting at?
Probably not. So my co-clerks for Justice Breyer, so of the four of us, one of them was Ketanji Brown Jackson, who has been confirmed to take over the seat that Justice Breyer has just retired from, or is about to retire from.
Right. So he's heard his last case, but he hasn't stepped off.
Yeah, now the opinions have to come out.
Right, right. So. Well, they talk about small world. Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. You know, we come to expect this sort of thing here in Texas among our judiciary and bar, but that really is an incredible connection. Just the fact that not only did she clerk for Justice Breyer, but now she's going to replace him on the court. And so we're curious about what it was like to work with her as a law clerk. And if you can you give us any insight on what we think we might be able to expect from her as a Supreme Court justice? You know, obviously we don't want to put you in a position of making any commentary that you feel uncomfortable with.
Oh, yeah.
It's not every day we have someone with your history with soon to be Justice Jackson that offers something from to our listeners.
Sure. Well, I might just keep calling her Ketanji because that's how I've known her forever. You know, I don't know anyone who knows her who doesn't like her. She was great to work with. She's incredibly level-headed, thoughtful, of course, super smart. So she was just a great person to have working with you in the office. Now, clerks don't normally work on opinions together. That's generally just you and the justice working on one opinion. But, you know, we share offices, we bounce ideas off of each other, that sort of thing. So I got to, you know, sort of see how her brain worked a little more up close. And in a lot of ways, I think she will be a lot like Justice Breyer in terms of approach to cases. It was very important to Justice Breyer that people, like everyone, not just lawyers, be able to read the opinions that he wrote and understand what he was saying about the law and how the law applied to ordinary life. And I think that that is something that's also important to Ketanji, that things be accessible to people who want to find out about the law. I think she will be different in terms of incorporating more current approaches to originalism and textualism into her reasoning. I'm not saying she will be, you know, Justice Scalia, but my guess is that she will be more like Justice Kagan, who I've heard people say, you know, Justice Kagan is the first progressive justice who speaks textualism as a first language. And that is something that I think Ketanji will be skilled at going forward.
Thank you for that.
Well, you know, we talk a lot on this show, too, about judicial clerkships generally. And as I mentioned, there's no short path to a U.S. Supreme Court clerkship, it wouldn't seem. But we would like to kind of get your take on clerking. I guess, first of all, maybe it would help my understanding to hear you talk about, you know, what is the path, if there's a commonly accepted path to a U.S. Supreme Court clerkship?
Well, so back in the dark ages when I did it, the commonly accepted path was essentially clerk for a court of appeals, clerk for the Supreme Court. That has expanded in the last 20 years. Many people do more than one clerkship. They may do a district court and a court of appeals. They may even do two courts of appeals clerkships. Many people also do something else relatively short term, like fellowship at the DOJ, work for a state SG's office, practice for a couple of years, that kind of thing. The clerks tend to be a little more seasoned than they necessarily were 20 years ago. And I can see some advantages to that, to the justices. You know, I teach law students. I know how little they know. And that's not an insult. That's just an observation. Sure. You know, it was true of us, you know, when we were law students too. Mm-hmm. And I worry, though, that it is putting that sort of clerkship out of reach of some students, ones who may have financial barriers to taking what are essentially low-paying jobs for a number of years. And it also weighs heavier on young lawyers who may want to have families. It's not sort of obviously a great plan to have a baby while you're clerking. Mm-hmm. there's no real maternity leave or anything. So I have worries about that, but I'll be honest, that is the way things stand right now.
You know, you're describing it that way, I hadn't thought about it, but it almost sounds sort of like a medical school residency. You know, it's a multi-year path that you may or may not get paid. Your hours are kind of wild and unpredictable, but that's...
It's a little bit. And I will say, you know, I probably learned more during my 2 years of clerking than I did during my 3 years of law school, at least as much. So it was incredibly useful. And I basically looked at it as a couple of extra years of law school, which I wasn't paying for, but I also wasn't getting paid that much to do.
It's definitely a sacrifice for those who go through it on the financial side. But I like to think that, you know, there's so much to be gained from it.
Oh, yes. I mean, I definitely recommend it to anyone who can swing it. Yeah.
Right. Do you have any other tips? You know, I don't know if you're, if you happen to be advising any of your students who are interested in clerking. I mean, obviously to most of us, a U.S. Supreme Court clerkship kind of seems like kind of a pie in the sky kind of dream. I mean, you have to have just impeccable credentials and, you know, a circuit court clerkship sort of is a stepping stone.
Yeah.
No, if you can't ever get to the circuit court clerkship in the first place, then it's not really something that probably ought to be dwelled on for too long, just as a practical matter. But what about other clerkships? I mean, circuit court's great. I think you mentioned district court clerkships as another possibility. And we've talked a lot here about state court clerkships and the fact that they really shouldn't be overlooked. But in terms of generating, cultivating advocacy skills and writing skills and all of that, you get the chance to talk with your students much about these sorts of things?
Yes. As you would imagine, in the Supreme Court clinic, a lot of my students are interested in clerking. And the right clerkship for a student is going to depend partly on where they can get hired. And it's also going to depend on what they want to do. If you're going to be a trial litigator, there are few more educational things than clerking on a district court, I think. You know, people come out of being district court clerks just knowing how that courtroom runs, how things really work, what judges are really looking at, all of that stuff. So I think that's invaluable if you were going to spend any time in the courtroom. If you're going to practice a lot in Texas, a Texas Supreme Court or Court of Appeals clerkship makes a whole lot of sense for a lot of those same reasons. And then also just the really learning about making arguments, how judges address things, all of those sorts of things. I will say that your experience and the amount of education that you get out of a clerkship depends a lot on who the judge is for whom you're clerking. Judges have different approaches. They have different ideas about how much teaching they should be doing of their clerks. And, you know, and some of them are just better writers than others. So it depends on who you're copying. So, you know, I encourage my students at least to find out as much as they can about the judges they're applying to. And a lot of them really do a lot of research, find out, they look at their opinions, they find people who've clerked for them in the past and talk to them. They're all really great ways of finding this stuff out.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. Well, now would be a good time to sort of focus on the clinic. We've talked about your students and your role in encouraging them with clerkships, but let's start from the beginning about the Supreme Court Clinic at UT. You know, you're spending the majority of your time, at least your professional time, is spent there. Just give us the elevator speech for the clinic and let's dive in.
So the UT Clinic is me, my co-director, Lisa Eskow, and our third co-director who says he's co-director emeritus, Michael Sturley, who is one of the founders of the program. And every semester, we have about 10 students who take the clinic as a 6-credit course. So it's about half their work for the semester. And we take real Supreme Court clients and represent them. We may be writing cert petitions. We may be writing merits briefs. We often write amicus briefs, although we do not always have time. If we're doing merits work, that's usually our first priority. We also, every semester, usually do a couple of moots to prepare someone who is arguing at the court. And those moots may be mostly professors, or sometimes they are the students actually doing the moot. So it's somebody who is, say, 3 weeks out from flying to Washington to do an argument, comes and we pepper them with questions for often upwards of an hour to really get them. The idea is that they won't hear any question in the Supreme Court that they didn't hear from us first. We do pretty well on that, actually. So that's the clinic in a nutshell. Students can come back as advanced students and do a credit, 2 credits, 3 credits in semesters following. We have had some students who have stuck with us for, 4 semesters in a row. They just like doing the work so much.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So they're coming to you then mostly as 2Ls, it seems like.
So a mix of 2Ls and 3Ls. So students apply for the clinic, and we mostly screen on the basis of, do we think they can do the work? And to be honest, the more law school they've done, the more confident we feel about making mm-hmm. that call. So in the fall, we'll have largely 3Ls, and then in the spring, we'll have a mix. So they do a lot of work. We probably have 4 classes that we talk about general, this is what goes in a cert petition. This is how to think about the arguments, that kind of thing. Then the rest of the time we are working, almost like a little law firm. Mm-hmm. Students are researching, we're brainstorming, we're arguing with each other about what should go in the brief, and just trying to get out a product that can go to the Supreme Court. Now, in the end, things have to be filed under my name or Professor Eskow's name.
Sure.
The court does not allow students to practice.
Right. Right.
But, there are 2 of us, and so we rely heavily on the work of the student. Sure.
I can see how that would be like a little law firm with a bunch of law clerks, essentially, but really smart law clerks and, people who've been screened and to the point where you feel somewhat confident they can do the work, and you're working on, I'm sure, important issues. Mm-hmm. I was curious about where some of the alums of the clinics that you've been involved have wound up. Have you seen any of your former students who have gone on to do great things, or folks we would have heard about, perhaps?
Well, you may have heard of Scott Keller, who became SG of Texas.
That name rings a bell.
I think so.
Yeah. So he is one of our former students. We have former students at DOJ. We have a lot who are appellate lawyers at various firms. We have a large number who are still clerking. We've sent at least one to the SG's office in Florida. So they've sort of scattered about the country, largely doing appellate law.
How many cases do you kind of handle at a time? I feel like with the 2 of you and the clerks, that demand has got to be huge and the supply is probably not quite as big.
Well, it's interesting because there's actually a huge competition for the kind of cases that we want to work on.
Mm-hmm.
We never take a case that we think is a non-starter just to have something for students to work on. We've just ruled that out.
Mm-hmm.
And so people do bring us cases, and once in a while, one of those is something we can work on. We also look for split circuit splits, cases that look like they would be good candidates for taking up to the court. And we have a few issues that we keep our eyes on, looking for cases that we think will be good. So it's not like we're buried under available cases. Mm-hmm. Getting good cases is actually a pretty significant part of my job at times. Sure. If we're going to do amicus briefs, that is more of a, there's almost always somebody who wants us to do one of those for them. Mm-hmm. And we also are limited, of course, in our cases to people who it's appropriate to do pro bono work for. Mm-hmm. Now, if your pro bono line is people who can't afford good Supreme Court representation, that's a pretty high line. You know, yeah. Most individuals will meet our category. But so that's sort of where our work comes from. Mm-hmm. We probably, as a practical matter, have only a couple of cases going at once. And we try to keep it so that things are in different stages to the extent mm-hmm. that we can. So we will have filed a cert petition in one case, and we will be waiting for the other side to file the brief in opposition. We can do a certain amount of preparing for our reply during that time, but we will also work on another case at that time. With only 10 students and two of us, you know, to be trying to file two cert petitions within a month of each other or something would just be a little bit crazy.
Sure.
I assume, I mean, by subject matter, you have the ability, of course, to work not only on civil cases, which is what we on this podcast focus on mm-hmm. largely just because that's our practice area, but some criminal cases too. Is that right?
We do some criminal work. So in terms of taking cases, I won't take any case that I think could put my students in danger. And we have been presented with a few of those. And we also try not to take any cases that a student would have serious moral qualms about working on. And that is just our choice. And because students don't know what cases we're working on when they sign up for the clinic, because we don't know what cases we're working on when they sign sure. up for the clinic. There's not that much lead time on Supreme Court cases. So those are sort of limits. But we have done First Amendment criminal work. We've done, I guess, a couple of amicus briefs in capital cases. And then this past fall, we took on what was technically a civil case, a case under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. But it was challenging the conditions of an execution. So it was a cross between a capital case and a
wow.
technically a civil case. So, and we will do a mix. Professor Sturley is an admiralty expert, so we've done kind of a surprising number of admiralty related cases. If we have an appropriate client and it's a good case, we will do pretty much any topic. Mm-hmm.
And you kind of alluded to it, but I know you wanted to specifically talk a little bit about the Ramirez versus Collier case.
Yes, just because it was an unusual case because it was on such a tight timeline. Mm-hmm. The court granted cert the day that Mr. Ramirez was scheduled to be executed. And instead of giving the usual amount of time, they gave us, I believe it was 27 days to write the petitioner's merits brief.
Wow.
It's usually considerably longer than that.
Sure.
And they also cut off, usually people filing amicus briefs get an extra week after the party they're supporting files, and they cut off that extra week for the amicus as well. And the case was going up. There had really not been evidence presented in the district court. It was an area of law that depends a lot on the government has to show that their actions are the least restrictive means of pursuing a compelling governmental interest. And that's supposed to be done on an individualized basis. So we knew that amicus briefs were really the only way the court was going to get a lot of the information that it needed to make any sort of decision about the case. And so Seth Kretzer, who was the prisoner's lawyer, called to ask us to help. We essentially had to turn around and call our students and say, hey, are you willing to devote the next, say, 6 weeks of your life to this. And it was also the beginning of the semester. So that was largely our advanced students, students we'd already been with for a semester or two. And luckily, all four of them said, yeah, we're in. And we were off to the races. But that was just such a, the students did such great work that I just love to tell everyone about the experience of working on that. And of course, we came eventually, you know, it was hurry up, file these briefs so fast, go to argument 2 months after the case was granted. And then we waited for 4 months for the court to come out with their opinion. But when it came out, it was 8-1 in favor of the prisoner.
Wow.
So it was a wild ride, but
it's an absolute victory. And what a tremendous experience for the students. I mean, do you have any provision for if one of your cases is going to go and be heard in Washington that they can actually attend the oral argument?
So in the before times, we would take students
every semester.
Sure.
We should say before times versus current times.
Yes. Yeah. And we are hoping to get back there. Even if we didn't have a merits case, we would take students. This time around, when Ramirez was argued, they would only let in two lawyers. They wouldn't even let in all of the lawyers. So there was not much point, you know, trying to take students to DC to sit on the steps. So we didn't.
Wow.
So the sort of silver lining is that the court now does live audio from the arguments. So we could all at least, you know,
listen in.
Right. I know the clinic is affiliated with UT, but because you are doing seemingly a lot of public interest work, is all the funding through the law school, or do you have separate sources of funding for the clinic, like grant funding, for example?
At this point, it is basically all through the law school. Now, I will say a number of years ago, we did work on a case where we recovered fees. And we recovered a lot of fees. So to a certain extent, we've been self-funded. But other than that, it's the law school pays my salary and the other professor's salary. And other than that, we don't spend a lot of money. We pay for printing and we pay filing fees. And
well, printing is no small expense in the cert stage.
Yeah.
Wow.
One thing I kind of want to ask about that's a subset of all this is sort of teaching appellate advocacy to law students and young lawyers. Do you have a particular focus, or do you just kind of do it along, you know, moving along the case process and just teach by doing, or?
We largely teach by doing. A lot of it is, I don't know if mindset is the right word, but with any sort of writing, knowing your audience is the utmost importance. And the Supreme Court is a very special sort of audience. They are, of course, interested in your case, but they're really interested. I always tell my students, they're thinking about the case after the case after your case. So the focus really has to be on how what they do in your case will affect the law going forward. And that's going to shape how you write a cert petition, what your emphasis is going to be. Your emphasis can't be that lower court was really wrong. It has to be bigger than that. It affects what you write in your merits brief. It affects how you do your oral argument. And so we are emphasizing that every step of the way. One other thing I haven't noticed as much recently, but it may have been the sorts of cases we've been doing recently. A lot of students aren't ready to deal with statute heavy cases. So much of early law school is still case law driven. And there are cases that we work on. The Ramirez case was very case law driven. And any of the First Amendment cases we do will be. But if we're working on a case about the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, like, it's really about statute, and it's about what other statutes say that have used the same words. And it's a different form of analysis that in the modern world, lawyers really need to be able to do. And absolutely. And that we find we are filling in that part of the education, I think, mm-hmm. a lot.
Are they teaching statutory interpretation in law schools these days? Because I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but and it's something that we deal with all the time, of yeah. course. But yeah. as a law student, I think everything I ever learned about statutory interpretation was in practice and not in law school.
Yeah, I tell my students that I don't think it matters that much which class they take, but they should take a class where they have to deal with a big, meaty statute. So it could be straight up ad law, it could be bankruptcy or securities regulation or, you know, just anything mm-hmm. where you just have this monster of a statute and figure it out.
mm-hmm. Well, I think that's good practical advice. So you're getting a lot of good practical experience in the clinic, period, it sounds like. I was curious about, you know, you're instructing them on the written advocacy clearly, but do you see a lot of your students go through the oral advocacy programs at UT to kind of strengthen that part of their skill set?
They do. They do. We don't get to give them experience in that, mm-hmm. except that they get to be on the other end of it in a way when we mm-hmm. do moot courts. And they, I will say, with the people we've had come in, they see a wide range of approaches and styles, and they get to really think about what is effective, what would work for me. You know, trying to adopt a style that is very much not your personality is probably not going to work, but they at least sort of see what the options are and what can be good and bad in using a certain style. So we have occasionally had alums, pre-clinic UT alums, Lisa Blatt and David Frederick, who are both incredible Supreme Court advocates, mm-hmm. who happened to be in the same year in law school, the same small section in law school even, who have diametrically opposed styles of argument. And Lisa comes in and she is on the attack from minute one and you know, she's just going. And David arrives and he's a little more like your favorite law professor explaining the case to you. And they're both great. And if David tried to do Lisa and Lisa tried to do David, I don't think they would be very good. But I love that our students get to see those different approaches and styles and be thinking about what will work for them when they go into court.
Oh, that's great.
Authenticity is the key in all of it, in the writing, the oral side of it, just all of it.
Well, they're clearly developing some really important skills in your clinic that you can develop those skills later, perhaps in a clerkship or just in practice, certainly. But you're showing them with the benefit of your experience as an advocate and your co-directors and all the people that they're exposed to. I think it's just a great, no doubt, a great experience for them, no matter what level the student that you're dealing with. So mm-hmm. it's been great to hear about what you all are doing over there. And now I have a resource. If I ever have a case, I'm like, I'm going to call Professor Busby.
We encourage it. You know, we love partnering with people on cases. To be honest, we do give out a lot of free advice too.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
Oh, look out. You're going to get some phone calls now.
Well, as we reach the end here, our tradition is always to ask for sort of a tip or war story. I don't know if you have anything you'd like to share as we wrap up.
Sure. Of course, you know, being a professor, one of the privileges is giving out a lot of advice. Mm-hmm. But one thing that students have told me that they've thought about a lot after being out, you know, in the real world is something we talk about. And I like to call it the arc of despair, which is a phenomenon I'd always known about. And then I was on a panel with a woman who was then SG of District of Columbia named Lauren Ali Khan. And she said, oh yeah, it's the arc of despair. And it is that when you take a case, especially if you're in a situation like we are, where you largely choose your cases, you think it's great. You're going in, you're going to win. It's super. And then you start working on it and you research And you start seeing the problems and you see more problems and you see the point that the other side has. And it gets worse and worse until at some point you're thinking, how can I get rid of this case? Can I back out now? It's terrible. There's no way you could win. It's a disaster. And at that point, you're at the bottom of the arc of despair. And if you keep working on it and keep researching and start writing, almost always, by the time you file the brief, you're sending it off to the court thinking, we are going to win this one. And you've reached the top. And probably you'll do it again on the reply brief. Mm-hmm. And when you're getting ready for an oral argument, there may be multiple arcs of despair. But the important part is to realize that it's an important part of the process. You will not have a good brief if you haven't reached that bottom of the arc of despair, mm-hmm. because you won't have dealt with everything that the other side has to throw at you. Those won't be incorporated into your brief. So I have had students come back and say, you know, I was working on something and it was really terrible. And then I thought, wait, it's the arc of despair. That is my most useful advice to students.
Todd and I are both smiling and nodding our heads because we know exactly what you're talking about. Although I'm going to have to borrow Arc of Despair because I really like that. And it's a perfect description.
I'm going to steal it completely. And in fact, I'm going to use it here in our firm in working with our younger lawyers. It's a brilliant description. Mm-hmm. And it's 100% accurate.
Yes, it is. So
that's a great tip. Thank you so much, Aaron, thanks. For sharing that with us. And thank you for being with us. We really appreciate you taking the time, mm-hmm. talking to us about what you're doing at the clinic. And it's just been really great to hear about.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.